Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Own Personal Beatles. I, as ever, am Jack Pelling.
And I'm Robin Allender.
Today's guest is the fantastic Mae Martin, stand-up comedian, writer and actor. We talked to her about being a Beatles superfan, some of her favourite sort of solo records. We talked to her about her Beatles tattoo and her new sitcom Feel Good, which is available on 4OD here in the UK and on Netflix and is absolutely fantastic. And you had a chat to her about Friends and Beatles, which was quite fun.
Yeah, well, we had to talk about the Lisa Kudrow thing because Lisa Kudrow's in Feel Good, didn't we? And, you know, that was quite nice. And we ended up talking about which friend would be which Beatle. But yeah, it was a really lovely chat because she's so personally invested in them. And I didn't realise, she's a musician herself. And so I sort of kind of related, I guess, because she is sort of, I'm very interested in people who do music and comedy. I think it's interesting, you know.
And there's some really great chat about that and the different sort of neuroses that come with.
Yeah, that was great.
Sorts of outlets.
And the really, and you know, she's a huge Elliot Smith fan as well, so that was good to chat about as well. So we'll put some Elliot Smith in the playlist as well.
Yeah, so, and if you want to find any of the music that we discuss on these episodes, you can go to Spotify and we'll make a little playlist for every single one. And as always, if you want to get in touch with the show, you can email me at jack@homespunsounds.com or go to personalbeatles.com/contact. We got an email that I'll read out this week, which is a really nice one. This is a guy from the US called Pat Hughes, who says, as a 19-year-old living in New York City, I found myself amongst the masses outside the Dakota Building on West 72nd Street, mourning the death of John Lennon. I was a young musician and was influenced massively by the Beatles. My career took off, and as a man, some years later, I worked as a property manager for one of New York's large property companies. Imagine my delight when I was asked to work as one of the two managers on the Dakota Building. I was in the office one day, and someone said that Yoko is away. Do you want to come and see the apartment where John lived? And of course, Yoko still occupied with her son, Sean.
Wow.
I jumped at the chance. On entering, there was a long hallway, and on the right-hand side, there was a large cluster of golden platinum records across the length of the wall. Sean also had a professional pinball machine with his name across the top, and I was thinking, that'll be worth a fortune one day. Later on that year, I had the privilege of meeting Yoko and Sean at the Dakota's annual courtyard party. She could not have been nicer. She appeared to dote on Sean, and she was obviously well-liked by the other building residents who she freely mingled and engaged with. I was a very lucky young man and enjoy sharing this story to this day.
That's lovely.
There you go.
That's incredible.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to share any of your personal Beatles stories with us, then do get in touch. You can also follow us on our usual social media accounts, @PersonalBeatles on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.
Cool.
But before we get on to Mae Martin and the rest of the show, how's your week been, Robin?
Yeah, I've had a good week. I've been dipping back into a really good music book called Electric Eden by Rob Young. So it's really good. It does feel like sometimes he's just talking about his favourite music. Like, he really likes talk, so wants to bring them in. But I think it's great. It's about kind of like people who I suppose are kind of visionary in some sense. That what makes Strawberry Fields Forever psychedelic and what makes it English? Strawberry Fields Forever is pregnant with whole futures of music, an underground bulb in its winter-long sleep. The song is radical lyrically too, impressionistic and syntactically perverse in places. The text alone resists confining itself to one specific subject, mood or experience. In fact, the lines enact non-specificity. It contains conversational evasions such as, that is, you can't, you know, tune in, always, no, sometimes, and I mean, yes. Hesitations unprecedented in pop lyrics of the time, repeated references to knowing and not knowing, misunderstanding, living with eyes closed, agreeing and disagreeing, are offset against the one certainty, the one thing that is forever, Strawberry Fields. And that certainty is based not on anything in the present, but on a memory. That's great.
Beautiful.
I love that. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And what's that book called? I might have to pick that up.
It's called Electric Eden by Rob Young, who writes a lot for The Wire. And Strawberry Fields is a song we mentioned with Mae Martin. We talk about with Mae Martin as being a very beautiful song. And, you know, we talk about the fact that it's mysterious and hard to work out and stuff like that.
Yeah, sums it up perfectly.
Yeah.
So on with the show. Just a quick reminder, if you do enjoy the show, please do give us a rating if you listen on Acast or Apple Podcasts. They are really important in getting more people to listen to the show, so it's very appreciated if you give us a nice 5-star rating and a review. We do read them all, and they do make us feel very good about ourselves. And if you do feel the need to correct some of the factual inaccuracies by either emailing us or leaving 1-star reviews, you're welcome to do so. But if you're going to count every single factual inaccuracy in the show, I'm just a warning that it's going to take you quite a long time.
Yeah, I think I just need to reiterate that this isn't an encyclopedic show about the Beatles. We don't know everything about the Beatles, and it's very much a podcast about people's own relationship with the band and the music. But, you know, I'm sorry if we get stuff wrong.
That's all right, which we will.
Yeah, which
okay.
we will.
Okay. So without further ado, please listen to our chat with the fantastic Mae Martin. Hi, Mae. How are you doing?
I'm delighted to be joining you.
Oh, hello. Big Beatles fan, I hear.
Yeah. Like, I'm worried I might get emotional in the podcast. That's how deeply I feel about them.
Emotion equals clicks. We need the emotion.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah. So this is a safe space.
Yeah.
I actually had that last week. I went and saw an old mate from school in the pub, and we just got talking about She's Leaving Home, and we found ourselves two men in their mid-30s about to burst into tears in public for absolutely no reason.
Wow.
Yeah. We gave her everything money could buy. That's a great line.
It's devastating stuff, isn't it?
It really is.
I could never listen to Julia. I had to, because it just made me cry. I think that was my tear-jerking one.
Yeah. Julia's real tear-jerker. Like, Golden Slumber sometimes gets me at the end of the end of the second half of Abbey Road. If you've gone on the whole journey, that big brass moment.
Yeah.
It's
magical. So, I mean, we're straight in at the
detail.
It's good stuff. So what was your, where did your kind of personal journey with the Beatles begin?
I guess my dad, I think my mum liked the Beatles, but my dad definitely has a real passion and had been in bands and stuff in his teens and was, grew up in England. I grew up in Canada. And so he kind of made sure that we had really early on a Beatles education and all those great, those songs that are great for kids, you know, that you start with, like Yellow Submarine and Magical Mystery Tour and Penny Lane, and those songs are so good for kids. And then as I grew up, they grew with me, you know, and then you find things that are relevant to you at every age. And and then I think the reason that I have like I just in my teens was quite a hippie and got into not that I'm glorifying these things at all, because trouble down the road, but I got really into mushrooms and weed and acid and stuff, and it was just at the time when I was getting into the White Album, and I just felt like I had this profound, I mean, you know, in that stoner way, I was like, this is what it's all about, man. These guys,
have you ever had that with like an album that you realized afterwards was like absolutely terrible? Have you had that experience?
Yeah, well, there's an album by Third Eye Blind, this kind of indie, 90s, that, at the time I was like, this is everything. And then
the meaning
listening
of life.
And really, his voice is so annoying.
So what kind of age was your dad then? Was he kind of older, of an age where he might have, was he around in the 60s?
Them.
He saw them,
yeah.
Wow, cool.
He saw them, my grandma took him at, I think, I want to say Royal Albert Hall, or maybe it was the Royal Variety Performance or something, because there's a photograph of my dad and his mum in one of the balconies, and beneath them, the Queen was there or something. So it must have been a Royal Variety Performance, and the Beatles performed, but he doesn't remember it. He was like a toddler.
That's amazing. Maybe it's the Rattle Your Jewelry one.
It may very well have been that.
Was there a particular record that was like one that you first remember getting into as an album?
Yeah, I remember thinking that I knew the Beatles and loved them. And my dad was very into the kind of whimsical stuff and a lot of the and Sgt. Pepper and a lot of the Paul stuff. And then I felt like my coming of age thing was getting into the the darker John stuff, and and the White Album was a big part of that, I think. And the White Album was, it felt so different to their other stuff because it was so, they were all doing their own thing on it. And I loved it all, but it was also slightly more discordant and weird. Like there's things like Piggies, you know, that song, or like you know, Number Nine and things like that.
Yeah, that's the thing I kind of remember is my dad, you know, I got a lot of the Beatles records from my dad. And then he hadn't heard them for so long that I'd play him something like, you know, I Want You, She's So Heavy from Abbey Road. And he was like, oh, God, this is noisy and goes on for too long. You know, it's weird. It's like I almost was, you know, it was almost that kind of, he sort of grown past that kind of stage of it or something.
Right. You know. Yeah, that second half of Abbey Road is wild. I have a Beatles tattoo.
Yeah, right. We were going to ask you about this.
Yeah, again, this is in my teens, and I was, you know, a wayward teen and had dropped out of school and stuff. And I had just stopped doing, this is going to feel like too much information, but I do talk about this in my comedy a lot. So it's like, and also you're looking for a click, so you want, you want some gritty. Yeah. I had just stopped doing coke, and I'd stopped doing coke for a little while, and I wanted to get a tattoo to kind of commemorate that. I was like, it was like memento in my teens. I just got tattoos very willy-nilly, really, really bad ones. And so I got really into the song I Dig a Pony from Let It Be.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And for some reason in my kind of stoned brain, I was like, this is their whole message as a band is you can celebrate anything you want. You can, and I got I Dig a Pony, you can, there.
Wow. Cool.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah. By my collarbone.
Yeah.
I Dig a Pony. And then I hadn't Googled it, though. And when I Googled it, the first thing that comes up is an interview with John Lennon saying it's his least favorite song that he ever wrote and that it's nonsense and he wishes he could erase it from his discography.
And didn't you say that your tattoo quite often gets misread as well? I think you remember.
Yeah, it looks like I dig pussy. So if I'm on the beach and stuff, people will be like, that's so brave that you
because,
say that.
I mean, I Dig a Pony is, I mean, it's sort of one of his more nonsense-y kind of songs, isn't it? So I have a friend, actually, who the first time he took acid, the next day he'd written a word down on a piece of paper and it was the word cup. In bubble writing.
Oh my god.
So do you think do you look back on that, do you still feel the meaning of what I Dig a Pony meant to you then, or do you think it maybe, or is it kind of a kind of more nonsensical thing?
One other problem with it is that I didn't realize that pony is actually it's a euphemism for cocaine, so I had got a tattoo I know that says I dig cocaine, so it kind of couldn't be worse, but aesthetically I don't mind it. I still like the song a lot. I like the rhythm.
I always thought it was something to do with money. Isn't a pony a cockney amount of money?
Yes, yeah, that sounds right. And I like Let It Be, the really stripped back Let It Be Naked, that version. I like how kind of acoustic-y and messy that sounds, and it sounds like they're just jamming on that song, and I like that.
It's quite, I haven't really never thought of it until we started doing this, that it's quite unfashionable to really like Let It Be.
Really?
And that it is why it would be considered to be like their worst album, but I never had that sort of, I wasn't aware of its reputation when I was growing up, so I love like, yeah, I love that. I put loads of stuff on that record. And now looking back on it, you can have, you know, the Phil Spector production and all of that is dodgy.
Mm. Yeah.
It was definitely like a formative one for me.
What's the song that goes, everybody had a hard year? And
that's I've Got a Feeling.
Yes. I think that's a great song.
Good.
Perfect example of Lennon and McCartney. They're two style, like A Day in the Life, with both of their kind of styles. McCartney melodic and positive, and then Lennon coming in with this. Mm. Undercutting it with this weird refrain,
yeah, and they're both of those are on the rooftop gig as well. So they're like, yeah, I just fondly remember everything that they played on the top of Apple or whatever, because it's just such
they
still sound so good considering it's like -3 degrees in the middle of January on a really windy roof. That's the most impressive thing about it.
So when you were growing up there, were you ever inclined to get into music yourself, or was like stand-up your kind of first love in that kind of?
No, I think I secretly wanted, and maybe still wanted, to do music. I have, I don't know if you can see, I have all these like I have a little setup with guitar. Oh, you can't really see. I have guitars and stuff.
Cool.
And
that's nice.
I play moody, angsty music. But it's just scary expressing your emotions without irony. So I bottled it. But
yeah.
My dad and I used to play Beatles, and he'd play the bass and I'd play guitar.
So cool.
What kind of songs did you cover when you were growing up?
Oh, a lot of Elliot Smith and
great.
Like depressing stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. This is my genre. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
You're in Warren Robins' wheelhouse.
That's a really interesting thing, because I've done music and stand up, and it is weird when you do stand up and you have that irony to fall back on, and you can have that kind of thing. A joke doesn't go well, you can turn it into another joke, or if you're doing a really serious song, you've got nothing to.
Yeah.
It's very exposing. And in a way, doing stand-up with just a mic is less exposing somehow, because you can hide behind.
Absolutely. You can say something meaningful and then go undercut it with, if you don't think it's landed, you go, just joking.
Just like, I do that with text messages, just sometimes write, ha ha, at the end, and just. Like,
after you've just confessed your love to someone.
It's a weird, it's a bit of a cliche that all comedians want to be musicians and musicians want to be comedians, but I think the Beatles definitely had that, and in another life any one of them could have slipped into Python quite well.
Yeah,
and they were all
they said that, didn't they?
Yeah. John Lennon said he wished he had been in Monty Python.
Yeah, and George Harrison funded Life of Brian.
Mm. Yeah, and the Ruttles as well, which is. Have you seen the Ruttles?
Yeah. My dad made sure I knew all this.
He just gave you this good musical education.
Yeah, and British kind of like the Goon Show and things that have Beatles-y echo, like the Bonzo Dog Band as well.
Yeah. I love Bonzo Dog, dude.
I rewatched Help the other day, the film, which very problematic racially now. But in terms of their performances, they're so funny.
Yeah.
They're really, and it's such a unique kind of comic sensibility too. I think this is when I was smoking weed in my teens, I really got into my head that the Beatles were some kind of vessel for like a universal consciousness that was flowing, like some magic. Like, how did these four boys find each other? And then all these amazing globally like resonant songs just flowed out of them.
I mean, this is one of the questions we've been asking all our guests is, did the Beatles even exist? Are they too good? I've sometimes had these things where you're listening to the White Album and it's like, how did they get this good this quickly, It seems like, you're right, it's something greater than the sum of their parts about them.
Absolutely, and no formal training, really. And then to move through that cultural revolution as well and continue to go from kind of Elvis-influenced stuff and then through the 60s and to be right at the forefront of it. I don't know. There's something else. Maybe it's all George Martin.
Yeah. Pulling the strings.
Yeah.
So was there something about, do you think, not to sort of get too cod psychological about it, but having that British humour when you're like in Canada with a British dad, or did it sort of remind you of your sort of roots or something?
Yeah, maybe. I definitely think there's something to do with, my love for my dad that is also part of why I love the Beatles, I'm sure. Because my dad also looks quite a lot like Paul McCartney. On the cover of that McCartney album where he's wearing a sort of sheepskin coat and he has a beard. My dad at that age looked identical. But I don't know. So maybe it was the British sensibility. I also loved Pink Floyd and they had the same kind of sense of humor in a lot of their stuff.
Was there a kind of thing when you were growing up then that you kind of you didn't have much to rebel against, do you think? You know what I mean? So because your dad was giving you these formative influences, was there any music you brought home that he didn't like or something? And
maybe. I mean, in my early teens I kind of was into the stuff of the day, but then you're right, all of my rebellious. But they were kind of surprised that I was rebelling so much, my parents. But I was like, but you just gave me The Wall to listen to. What do you expect is going to happen? Yeah. The veil had been lifted on reality, I felt like. And I felt like, especially Pink Floyd. And I just remember thinking, oh, my God, it's you know, all those stoner thoughts about like the flimsy scaffolding of reality and that we're all participating in this mad. I was just, I couldn't stay in school. I couldn't believe. Yeah.
But that, so yeah, it must have been strange because we both listened to the Adam Buxton podcast and you talked about your dad. He was quite into a lot of this stuff too, as well. He wrote a book about astral projection. Is that right?
Yeah. But he didn't have the same kind of urge to like burn it down. Like he was into the mystical stuff and mystical. He still is very whimsical and dreamy and but he wasn't kind of outraged. Whereas I felt like outraged. Right. I don't know, in a way. Yeah. I don't know.
So was John the sort of most attractive Beatle for you then growing up? Were you like his sort of more acerbic and anarchic kind of sensibility?
Definitely in my teens, and then I've definitely changed course, and now I'm a deeply McCartney.
Mm. That's funny, isn't it?
I think it's because now I'm quite ambitious, and I suddenly am thinking about the Beatles and how really all Paul wanted to do was keep making albums, and he was just as amazing lyrically, maybe definitely better musically. Like, do you think more conventionally?
I mean, I like did music at university and stuff, so I've always been really into like the thing I find astounding about him is how fully formed ideas just came to him, like fell out of the sky completely naturally. Mm. And he just sort of he had like the secret cipher for decoding like harmony and stuff with no formal training. It's just, I find it absolutely mind-boggling that he can write stuff like that that's sort of technically perfect.
Yeah.
Whereas John, I think we were talking to Ellis James last week about the sort of, it's like when you get more right wing as you get older and everyone starts off liking Ringo and then you like John and then you have a little George phase and then everyone ends up mellowing with Paul.
That's
at the end.
That's exactly my trajectory too. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think I love his storytelling and also I think if you're nerding out and reading books about them and stuff, just John becomes a less attractive personality.
Oh, totally, yeah. He's definitely more problematic the more you read about him.
Yeah, totally. But and Paul sort of gets away with it.
I think the great thing with John is he does still have that melodic side, but it's much more buried, isn't it? He does a lot of kind of melodies that are kind of one-note melody, kind of Julia being one, you know. Mm. And so they don't have that kind of almost classical element aside that McCartney does.
Yeah, you're
still,
right.
It's still there, you know. But the thing as well, John just had that thing tendency to want to kind of burn it down. I always think it's so beautifully characteristic of each Beatle when they do their three guitar solo thing at the end of Abbey Road.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and they switch, and you can just tell which one's which, and John's just doing that. Smashing it. Yeah, but it's just.
Yeah,
it's
you're right. Brilliant. He was into a lot of repetitive rhythmic, like even something like Dear Prudence is only.
Strawberry Fields to me feels like one of those songs where the melody seems to have fallen out of the sky. It sounds like a melody you hear in a dream or something. And I remember that we were talking about songs that made you cry. I remember Strawberry Fields was one song I never wanted to work out on the guitar because I just thought, oh, that would just destroy its mystery. I'd never be, you know. Yeah.
That's interesting about the songs that you don't want to learn because you just don't want another magic.
It's funny the people that we talk to from like slightly different generations is like, some people say that they had to sort of hide the fact that they listened to the Beatles at school because it was so uncool. Whereas I think because I'm a little bit younger and I grew up during Britpop when, like, the Beatles were the coolest thing ever. Mm. So were they, like, quite on trend when you were young?
I had one best friend called Nicole Simon and it was definitely a mutual journey. And I remember watching the documentary for Let It Be, about the making of that album. And we were crying, like real tears, about just how much we fancied them, how much we wished we were in the studio, just their talent. Like, we got really overwhelmed emotionally. Yeah, it was a really intense level. She has a Beatles tattoo as well, which is, it's the doodle that John does of himself.
Oh, right, cool.
Yeah. So we sort of went through it together, I think. But and we were kind of oblivious to what everyone else was doing.
So when did you get into stand-up? Because you were really young when you started performing, weren't you?
Yeah, when I was about 13. Yeah, and I met her around the same time.
Yeah.
And she and I did sketch comedy with another girl, and then they ended up wanting to do school, and I kept going.
Wow.
Yeah. So maybe that was I had a lot of older friends who were comedians, so maybe that was part of it. Like, I was absorbing their influences.
Mm. And were the Beatles part of that? You getting, because for me, it's all mixed up together in my childhood. Like, getting into music was almost as powerful as getting into comedy. You know, it was all mixed up together somehow. You know, there would be comedy shows you'd see, like the Young Ones or something, and that would be as kind of, you know, revolutionary to you as like hearing Sergeant Pepper or something. So was those two things closely linked to you?
I think so. Yeah, there was a Canadian sketch comedy troupe called Kids in the Hall that had.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I loved them. And
I felt like they were rock stars to me, and that was pretty mind-blowing at the time. And I'm so grateful that we all got to grow up without the internet, really. And I mean, it was just starting in my teens, but I didn't grow up with it, so I'm so lucky that I listened to albums and I had a Discman, and I would take out a whole Beatles album and listen to. I just feel grateful that I had the space to be bored and just lie around and listen to music and doodle pictures or whatever. Because these days I mean, all through lockdown, I've just been on my phone.
Yeah.
It's so bad. I barely listen to anything, really.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I had this Beatles for acoustic guitar book. And if there was a song on there, I'd kind of have to cross-reference it with, like, my dad's albums and, like, figure out which album it was on. And, you know, you had to do this detective work, but nowadays everything's so kind of obviously click of a button.
Yeah.
I had that same book, I think, and there are still to this day quite a lot of Beatles songs. And the thing, like, things on Yellow Submarine and stuff where I never had access to that record growing up, but all I had was my own version of it from learning the chords and, like, badly misreading the thing. So whenever I hear them, it's like, oh, that sounds wrong, that's not what it's like in the book, but obviously I was just playing it wrong.
But that, I mean, this funny. Is something that's really come in, like, you know, because we had that guy from Spotify, the CEO, said musicians need to put music out more, which has kind of attracted a lot of criticism, obviously, but this idea that maybe it's not a good thing that all music is available all the time,
right?
You know, you think, like, people would hear a song on John Peel or something and they try and create how they remembered it, so we're kind of losing that kind of weird influence of music, I think, somehow.
Yeah, I never want to be one of those people that's like, gotta listen to things on vinyl, but I do get that it does sound better.
It's just not being able to change it, or like actually having to make an effort to change it, rather than you're like, oh, skip, or someone else picks up your phone and, or even worse, asks Alexa to put something else on.
Yeah.
Listening to that.
Also, because I used to listen to Sgt. Pepper a lot on vinyl as a kid, I think the sound of the needle skipping is almost part of the song A Day in the Life in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you reach the end of that song and that big chord, and then in my head, then there's the sound of a needle skipping.
What is that noise? Do you know, Robin?
It's got, people thought it was Paul saying, fuck you, Superman. But it isn't, because it's nonsense, or it's garbled, I think. But someone will definitely write in and let us know what it is.
I remember being really disappointed with working out that it wasn't just my parents' copy of it that had that on it. I thought it was some like glorious mistake.
Our record player always the needle always came up before it got to that locked groove. So I was really annoying. Like, I'd heard about this thing and I'd never actually heard it.
Where can you find now the anthology documentaries? I can't find them anywhere.
Funnily enough, a few people have asked us about it. Yeah, because we were talking about it a lot last week. Basically, you have to buy them on a physical format on eBay or something. They're not available on like streaming sites. But I mean, if you are so inclined, I think one could find them relatively easily on the internet. But they're missing a trick by not re-releasing them.
Yeah. Alice James could quote it to you pretty much word for word, I think, if you ever
really, yeah.
Yeah, just ring Alice and he'll spare 12 hours.
Yeah.
I ended up sort of stopping reading Lennon interviews in the last few years of his life because I didn't want to hear him shitting on things that I loved. And yeah, but I did. I remember him saying that the best song he ever wrote was Help. Did you read that?
Yeah.
And that I like that. Yeah. That I found interesting. And
there's, I think if you just stick to interviews from like post 1975, they're much more palatable.
Okay. Yeah.
Wasn't there an interview in, I think it was in Playboy, weirdly, but it was where he basically went through every Beatles song, and that's where that Help quote's from. He basically gave an opinion about all the Beatles songs.
Yeah.
This is in Revolution in the Head, I think. But,
yeah. And some quite unkindly as well, I think.
Yeah.
I got really obsessed with their solo stuff.
Oh, nice.
And I was really into that back and forth between him and McCartney with How Do You Sleep and Dear Boy, and when they were writing these vicious songs about each other. It's so sad, but then also so gripping, like a soap opera. Yeah.
What's your favorite Beatles solo record?
Oh, that's really hard. As an album, as a standalone album, I think All Things Must Pass might be. But then I would never say, because I think the album McCartney, I think, is also amazing. And I think taken as a whole, I'd have to say McCartney. But then I've really gone on a journey with that because I used to be obsessed with Mother and all of those really angry Lennon songs. And there's a song called Remember that I love by him. And I don't know. It's really hard.
What about you? It's a cruel question because it changes all the time.
It really does. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you guys?
I think I'd say All Things Must Pass.
You're All Things Must Pass. I love Living in Material World. I think it's amazing. And it might be just because it's the one that I got into the last. But I don't know. I also love, I mean, I do love Imagine. And I love, you know, I've watched that documentary so many times. Just I find that, I think it makes me love it more seeing, because it's documented so, like, forensically. And stuff like Oh Yoko, and it's like even the throwaway tracks I sort of really, really like.
Yeah, and even now, like, I feel like I've said negative things about John, and now I'm suddenly feeling all this guilt about, and I'm thinking about how wounded he was and how talented, and so I really do go back and forth. I hate when people say, oh, I hate John, or they have such strong opinions like that, because you can't take one of them out of the equation like that.
And you always feel the like instinct to defend him. There's an interview, I think, with George Harrison after John had died, and he's asking about John, and I think some sort of slightly pompous BBC presenter is like, he wasn't a very nice man, was he? And John just goes, well, he was and he wasn't, but he was. And it's sort of, you do get to see that in that, especially there's a bit in that Imagine documentary where that this kind of guy who's obviously been taking a lot of drugs and has kind of lost his mind a little bit, comes and he's like saying, demanding to like make him explain that he wrote one of those songs for me, and he's like, I didn't even write that one, it's Paul's.
It's Carry That Weight, isn't it? It's a bit like finding out I Dig a Pony is about cocaine, isn't it? That must have been
really... At least you didn't have to make like a 5,000-mile round trip. But then he invites him in, and he's like, have we got any food for him and stuff? And you're like, what an unbelievably sort of generous thing and unnecessary thing to do.
Don't confuse the songs with your own life. I mean, they might have relevance to your own life, you know, but a lot of things do.
It all fits.
Anything fits, you know, if you're tripping off on some trip. Anything fits, you know.
Can you say, boy, you're going to carry that weight for a long time?
That's Paul saying that.
Paul saying
that? Well, that belongs to all of us. He's thinking about all of us.
Remember that one, you can radiate everything you are, you can penetrate anywhere you go?
Yeah. I was just having fun with words. It was literally a nonsense song.
You know, these days we cut people so much slack for the kind of trauma and stuff, and that this is sort of before all that, and they didn't know how to talk about feelings, I imagine, and had lost parents and were suddenly so famous, and it must have been absolutely insane.
It's probably worth reevaluating that, and especially because he's such a, you know, it's all there in The Groove. You know, he's such an incredibly expressive person and such a, like, traumatized person as well.
Yeah.
He went through a lot.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One of the questions that we ask everyone on the podcast is, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I don't think it's controversial, but I'm sure some people would. I think there's one Beatles song that I don't like, and it's the only one. And it's Obladee Obladah.
Talking about this yesterday. It's,
really?
Yeah, my least favorite Beatles song.
Really? Oh, yeah. I'm so glad. Yeah.
I can't stand it. It's like I spend my whole life trying to defend Paul for people who think that he's like sort of Nash and Kitsch.
Yeah, and
then
same.
And then it's always just like the easiest stick to beat at you with. Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, he wrote Obladee Obladah. Argument over.
Yeah. It's so cringe. There's something about the tone of his voice too. How pleased he is with it. It's no good. Yeah.
There's also one that, like, it's also, I really hate people who like it as well.
Yeah.
Well, how could you defend Obladee Obladah? Do you think it's a good thing?
It's an atrocity.
But what was he going for? He was trying to do like a kind of ska song, right?
And that's the only time. That's the worst thing about it. It's like,
do you think that's the worst thing that it's almost like?
Well, it's so lame.
What do you think? Because of the appropriation element, or because of the?
I think it's just calypso. White people doing calypso is just the lamest thing. You know, it's
lame.
A bit like the sort of. It reminds me of the QI theme tune. There's something about it that's just so pathetic.
But then, at least he was taking big risks. Like, I'm sure Helter Skelter wouldn't have happened if he hadn't tried that. Yeah.
I think you need, and you need it on the White Album. As I think you need all those shit songs.
Yeah.
You know, but
it is bad. It's bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like the film the Yesterday film, the Richard Curtis one that came out a couple of years ago, and you've got all of these songs. The deal that Apple gave them was like, you will let you have like 12 songs or something, and then they finish with this massive. Like, you know, grand finale of Obladee Obladah. It's just like, come on, guys.
Oh my God.
All the songs you could have picked.
Yeah. I didn't know that. I refuse to watch it because I'm just too worried. My least favorite thing is covers of Beatles songs where they've just fucked with the rhythm. Like someone taking the song Something and just completely changing the rhythm of it. Often on X Factor or something, you'll see someone doing a cover of a song.
That should be punishable by long prison sentences.
Yeah, totally. Or like kind of elevator music, like lift music. That's a kind of a corny version of... The only cover... Oh, I guess this is a solo Lennon song, but Donny Hathaway's Jealous Guy, I think, is an excellent... And he's changed the rhythm and
Have you heard the Al Green cover of I Want to Hold Your Hand? Because that's
that's amazing.
That's really?
Really good. He puts a lot of fun. I mean, they kind of work as souls, like the Stevie Wonder cover of We Can Work It Out.
I think they
do lend themselves to that kind of cover somehow.
The Joe Cocker, A Little Help from My Friends.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some really good, like, especially like soul artists seem to cover the Beatles and like deconstruct those songs in such a cool way.
Because
otherwise you're just sort of, well, why are you doing it? I mean, actually, because Susie mentioned last week that Elliot Smith covered Because, and I hadn't heard that. And I went back to listen to it.
It's amazing. It's very, very
well, it's
faithful.
Amazing, but it's also note for note.
Yeah.
To the point where you're like, what's the point?
Yeah.
I know, it's a bit like something I would do in lockdown using GarageBand to just like mimic it to see how it sounds. It was, his voice has that reedy, like kind of, when Lennon was doing heroin later in his life.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and the double tracking of his voice. Elliot Smith is very Lennon-esque.
Yeah.
And,
Elliot Smith, so underrated in terms
he's incredible.
Of like, composition and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just total genius, I think, Elliott Smith. It's, I think, you know, I once tried to work out, do you know the song Pretty Mary Kay on Figure
Yeah.
8? An amazing song. And I just tried to work it out, and it's just incredible. It's like, it's very McCartney-esque and so intricate. Every time it goes to Pretty Mary Kay, it's like a different chord, kind of gets more and more intense, and then yes. gets this resolve at the end. And it's like, it's just something. I mean, he was, yeah, just a genius.
Yeah, I agree. I have I have Figure 8 framed on my wall just there.
Oh, amazing.
And yeah. I went on a pilgrimage to the mural in LA
yeah.
the cover, and some fucking restaurant has bought that and put a door in the middle of the mural. It's
right, yeah. Wow.
Terrible,
me and my friend Phil had our photos taken there.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
It's kind of it's a weird thing as well, because it's like, it's at the end of Sunset Boulevard, right? And
yeah.
there's not really much going on there in the day.
Oh.
And me and Phil, we were there for a friend's wedding, and it's my friend Phil, and we tried to go in like a pub crawl, and pubs are really open in the day there.
Yeah.
So it was just basically a long walk down a street to have a photo outside a wall. But, you know,
yeah.
we had a great time. Very fond memories.
I like Elliott Smith does something that the Beatles also do that I find so satisfying, which is like when things become really chaotic in a song and then they kind of collapse into a really satisfying, like She Came In Through the Bathroom Window,
Yeah, right. The
opening to that, or in Day in the Life, when it just as it gets quite stressful, it then collapses into some really juicy kind of,
yeah, definitely that. Towards the end of his career, like the posthumous album From a Basement on a Hill, Elliott Smith, there's a lot more noise on it. It's a lot more chaotic, but it's still got the beautiful melodies and guitar playing, you know.
Yeah.
Chaos is remarkably hard to do on record.
Yeah.
Frank Ocean samples, he starts singing some Elliott Smith on his recent album.
Oh, cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you know what track that's on?
It's in the later half.
On Blonde or on the...
Yeah, on Blonde.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, and he does... I can't remember what bit, but he's definitely got Elliott Smith in there.
Yeah. Mm. There's some Beatles. It's got Here, There and Everywhere is sampled on that record as well. It's quite rare to be able to sample the Beatles these days. You have to have quite deep pockets, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
How did the Beastie Boys do that with Paul's Boutique then? Because it's just...
Well, the classic thing of forgiveness rather than permission, I think.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I think when the Dust Brothers recorded that record, sampling was such a new technique that record companies were quite slow to catch up on it. So if you listen to stuff like Eggman off Paul's Boutique, it's got samples of like... three different Beatles songs,
and
it's got
time.
Like the drum beat from the end of Sgt. Pepper. Mm. There's another song that's got like When I'm 64 on it and stuff.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to do that now.
No.
Time and money for girls covered with honey. Till I aspire to be as cunning. Feeling a rock and a roll, a B-size D-cup. Order the corner deluxe. Why don't you wake up? My mind is kind of blowing like an oil projector. And you get up and you get the Jimmy Protector. Went to surf and work and exploded. She woke up in the morning and her face was coated.
I've never heard that album.
It's great. It's Paul's Boutique.
It's
a really good album.
Yeah.
I mean,
really?
It's superb. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm saying that as a kind of, is that my 17-year-old self saying that?
Yeah.
Or is that actually a really good album?
Absolutely. I listened to it. I've got it and I got it out the other day. And I listened to it all the through, and I was like, considering it's so much earlier than you always think of it being as well. It's like 1986, Paul's Boutique.
Really?
Yeah, it sounds like a 90s album. You know, it sounds
absolutely.
Kind of...
It's amazing, yeah.
So I was going to... So I don't know how to get on to talking about Feel Good, but but we both absolutely loved it. And
Thank you.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Really good, and, you know... I don't know if there's a way to segue the Beatles into talking about this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, music was a big part of... I was obsessed with the soundtrack, so being involved in it.
The music used in it is brilliant, actually. Yeah.
Thanks. And it's always a battle at the end. How much budget do you have left to get songs? And then we had, luckily, we had a composer. Do you know a band called Slow Club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know Rebecca well.
Yeah.
Reasonably well. I met her a couple of times. Yeah.
I know. I toured with them, and then so Charles Watson, the guy from Slow Club, did he and his friend composed.
That's great.
Some stuff for Feel Good, and I got to play guitar on one of the songs. And
oh, amazing!
Yeah, so
oh,
it was really cool. Yeah, it was. So cool. I did care a lot about, because I think when you fantasize about doing a TV show, when you're like, yeah, a big part of it is moody music and
getting to be totally, like, do you ever like make a playlist and you're like walking through the city and it's like, oh, this is the establishing shot here.
exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. But what I loved about Feel Good is that the characters are so complex. And there was good and, I mean, we're talking about John Lennon being good and bad. But, you know, I think that's what's so good about it. Your character's so sympathetic but wasn't perfect. And,
thanks.
You know, it's about, I don't know, I just thought that was so well presented. And it's been, it was very moving as well. It's great.
Oh, I'm glad, yeah. We definitely wanted to make sure, that no one was all good or all bad. And
How much of yourself was in that? Because obviously the character is your name and you're going, like, well, this is... Probably gonna ask this a lot, but it was how much kind of overlap was there?
I think a lot. A very healthy amount, I think. I was in some areas heightened, in other areas toned down, and it was just, I mean, you start with a version of yourself that's pretty true to yourself, but then of course the main thing is telling a really satisfying narrative with the whole world that makes sense, so then you end up warping that central character as well. So
does the semi-fictional May have a Beatles tattoo as well, or did you cover
it's in there. it must be in there. And then at the end of the series my character gets a Sum 41 tattoo.
Oh yeah.
And now I'm like, fuck, if we make any more I'm gonna have to have this fake Sum 41 tattoo.
And what's that? So, getting Lisa Kudrow on board was, I mean, how did that come about? She's so great in that role, you know.
Yeah, she's really got that kind of powerful presence that you want a sort of matriarch character to have.
Yeah. And is she like your mum in that kind of role?
They have similarities, that they're both very intelligent and powerful and can, and a huge influence in my brain. And she just read the scripts. We sent them to her. I was like, never even thinking that she'd take the time to read them. And then she was really quick coming back, and she's just been so supportive. And I can't believe she flew to Blackpool. I still can't get over it. We had nothing to offer her. Like, we had our craft services table was like some biscuits, and like she was just so gracious about everything. We were like, we're really sorry, we have no good snacks. And she was like, oh, I really like these digestives. What? Like, just being really positive about everything. Cool.
Yeah, that's when you know people are lying.
Yeah.
There's nothing remarkable about a digestive.
Yeah.
My girlfriend and I have just been, I think we're watching a few things, but we find we can't watch much like challenging TV at the moment in lockdown. So we've basically watched every episode of Friends.
Yeah, like, me too.
Series of Friends, but it's like,
in
Lisa
a way,
is amazing.
Friends are like the Beatles of sitcoms. And
I was
going
to say, this was a question I had written down. which one would be which? I mean, although there's six Friends,
because they're kind of like this ubiquitous part of the cultural landscape that you can't ever pull out of your own psyche. I don't know where I start and like the Beatles, the Simpsons and Friends end, you know what I mean? They must have been so formative that I've been rewatching Friends too. It's so soothing and like properly funny still.
It is really funny.
There's great. Also a rumor that Matthew Perry died during season 3 and was replaced by a doppelganger. Don't know how much truth there is to that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I was going to say, Matthew Perry's definitely the John of the Friends, though, isn't he?
I mean...
It's a tricky one.
Yeah, I guess you're right. And it's a shame that I'm immediately ascribing Beatles characters to the men on the show. Like, maybe...
Well, Phoebe would be George, I guess, because the spiritual...
Yes.
It's true.
Joey's Ringo.
Yeah.
Monica's quite poorly as well. And keeping the band together.
And then Rachel and Ross are just doing their own thing.
Yeah, George Martin and Pete Best.
I think
Rachel as Pete Best is quite un... I mean,
yeah. Yeah. Or who is it? Brian Epstein, one of them?
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you think this that John like... had an affair with Brian Epstein? I know there's some...
Yeah.
It's definitely something that, like, the evidence... If they didn't, then he was certainly, like, embarrassed enough about the rumours of it to have beaten the shit out of someone for suggesting it.
We sort of discussed this briefly when we were chatting to Ellis, and I listened back to it, and I can't believe how blushingly I described the rumours. Like, I just sounded like my dad talking about it. Like, wasn't there a rumour that they, you know, once... they were, you know, like
commune totally, doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Hugh granted my way around a hand job.
Yeah. That's really funny. Yeah,
They definitely had a weird, I think, relationship because there was definitely like a love hate thing. And he could be really horrible to Brian Epstein as well. I think there's that line in Baby, You're a Rich Man.
Yeah, I mean, that's
and it's
awful.
On the record.
Yeah.
Where. In the backing vocals, it's like, baby, you're a rich man, baby, you're a rich Jew, I think he said.
No, yeah, I think Lennon had an interesting relationship with, like...
parental figures.
And homosexuality, like, because later on he did Whatever Gets You Through the Night, and he, you know, with Elton John, and that was his last live performance, I think, was that an Elton John concert.
Garden or something.
So I feel like he made peace with it, and...
Yeah.
But
he went on so many sort of journeys like that because he was writing really horrible misogynistic lyrics and then making, you know, huge feminist anthems.
Statements,
and,
yeah.
You know, like he was such a sort of, I think that's why people are really attracted to him. Like, you know, we all were in your adolescence because he's such a situationist that he moves around from being like obsessed with whether it, you know, getting into drugs or getting into like spiritualism or getting into acting or getting into poetry, and but then he just seems to sort of get bored of them and drop them and like move on to something else, and that's kind of what you do when you're an adolescent. So it's quite an attractive thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And I love his poetry. Yeah, I love his books.
Yeah,
A Spaniard in the Works. And,
Yeah.
I always think of it that it's called the version that is in the Ruttles, which is Out of Me Ed, which is Ron Nasty's book.
I just reordered on during lockdown. I ordered Tarantula that Bob Dylan wrote.
Oh yeah, God, I've tried to read that. That is
it's hard to get through.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's just like stream of conscious kind of, you know, trying to do a Jack Kerouac kind of thing, but without the kind of not quite Jack Kerouac.
Did you listen to the new Dylan album?
No, I heard that song that I liked a lot.
Yeah, it's really good. He's still got it.
I love it. I've been listening to it loads, actually. That's probably my most played record of
really?
The last sort of month or so. Yeah, it's just incredible. I mean, I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan anyway, but it's like to be writing at that level when you don't really have any need to.
Yeah.
It's like really inspiring.
Oh, I need to listen to it then because I got quite disillusioned in the past 10 years about like where is he, why would you just stop?
Never go and see him.
I did. And
that takes a long time to recover from.
Oh my God, I saw him and he didn't say a word to the audience the whole time. He didn't even introduce the band, and he just stood by a keyboard. He didn't, and then he left. It was
where
so
did you see him?
Like in Toronto.
I saw him at Brixton Academy and he wasn't even facing the front.
No. Oh,
and he had this
so
huge
sad.
Hat on. And it was basically just, we found it funny after a while. And then it basically turns into a game of guess the song.
Yeah.
The only thing that is recognizable is the occasional lyric. It's like, Visions of Joanna. I got a bit.
Did you watch Rolling Thunder Review on Netflix?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's so good.
It was amazing.
Brilliant.
Fuck,
I mean, yeah, imagine him seeing him on that tour. That's extraordinary. The version of Isis on that is just like
unbelievable,
amazing,
and Simple Twist of Fate, and just that he was at his peak, wasn't he then?
Yeah.
And he just seemed like a happier guy and a nicer man than
the thing I like about the new album though is his voice. You know, the voice has put me off on the recent albums, but he doesn't seem to have that kind of, he doesn't sound like he's singing through a hole in his throat anymore. It does sound a bit more melodic now, his voice, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely got through that very raspy stage. Articulate, like you can hear every single word. There's that. What's the huge long song that's the whole of the last side?
Oh, the one about JFK. Murder most horrid, most foul.
Yeah. Citing Indiana Jones and Frank in the same line.
I'm just like Aunt Frank, like Indiana Jones. And them British bad boys, the Rolling Stones. I go right to the edge. I go right to the end. I go right where all things lost are made good again.
I'm pleased that he's got stuff to say about the world. He played during the civil rights movement, and it would be great if people like that were involved now, especially as we're trying to kind of get boomers on board with some of these causes and get them to be slightly less apathetic about the, it would be great if McCartney would be a little more outspoken, but I'm glad he's put out a good album. Roger Waters is still putting out very angry protest music.
He's still kind of very politicized, isn't he?
The Led Zeppelin,
Robert Plant.
Yeah, Robert Plant. I like his recent music.
Yeah, he's really managed to just keep things rolling, hasn't he?
Oh, his voice is still just amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I was like that. I think when that Bowie record came out, a lot of people, like not septuagenarian faded rock stars, were like, "All right, you can still make something really sort of relevant and like artistically urgent."
Yeah.
Even in, you know, when you're knocking on heaven's door, so to speak.
Yeah.
I know, and I wish McCartney would team up with someone like who's a McCartney fan who would be like, this is what we want. And
Chaos and Creation in the Backyard gets quite close to that, I think. That's a great
album. Is that the Nigel Godrich one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
It's very good. I mean, it's really like, because some of the production is really sparse and unusual, and it's
yeah,
I think that's kind of
I quite sort of enjoy his last album's like quite fun and stuff. I went to go and see him last
I can't
Christmas.
Believe he did an album called Kisses on the Bottom.
I know that's unforgivable. This is a man who's amazing at stringing words together, and he puts those,
but it's one of those things where it's not even a double entendre, because you can only I mean, kisses on the bottom of a letter is the joke. But when you hear kisses on the bottom, I don't, you know, there's only one level at play there, I think. Really.
Yeah, I never even thought about the letter thing.
Sounds like a sort of chapter from Roger Moore's autobiography. But when I saw him and he came and introduced some of his new stuff, and he's like, this is a song about bullying and stuff. It's like, oh, come on, please.
God,
like,
I know. Oh, I was just for some reason jumping back to Rolling Thunder review, and when Joni Mitchell goes backstage,
that's amazing.
That was great. Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
I loved the way that they were so sort of playful with the narrative and the awareness of the ridiculous attention to detail that gets put onto those stories, and then just to sort of invent characters and mess around with the sort of, you know, it's like they're deliberately poking fun at you for like holding this stuff in such high regard. Like pretty much like the glass onion thing, isn't it? It's like that self-mythologizing sort of two fingers up to the nerds.
I read Chronicles, the Bob Dylan autobiography, which is amazing, and he manages to give so much detail and yet give nothing away about himself. I remember in it he said somewhere that when he was very young, what felt more real to him than the news of the day was like the sinking of the Titanic and the Gettysburg Address and things like that, and that really resonated with me, where I was like, Dylan and the Beatles, that feels more real to me. And the Vietnam War and stuff, that feels more vivid to me than anything that's going on currently, which is so weird how we kind of, I guess it's just, I don't know
it's
why
it's
that
hard
is.
To process what's going on at the moment, isn't it? Kind of, I remember in the 90s thinking, how are people going to categorize this decade? You're not aware of it at the time. And now looking back, the 90s is such a kind of, it's so clearly had a vibe.
Yes, you know? Yeah.
You could do a mood board that would sum it up pretty well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, as you're growing up, you do tend to get drawn to the past era, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's right. You can't process it as it's happening.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, what will people think about 2020?
I know.
So that was Mae Martin. What a fantastic chat. I really enjoyed that one. I think that's one of our finest episodes yet, I'd wager.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It felt very like we're on the same level with our appreciation of the Beatles. Maybe it's a slightly generational thing somehow.
Yeah,
maybe.
And very personal, which is exactly kind of what we wanted the show to be. So
yeah.
Really enjoyed that one. And if you want to go and listen to any of the songs that we talked about in that show, then you can go to our Spotify playlists. It's quite an eclectic list this year because we really did talk about quite a lot of music.
Yeah, yeah.
So fantastic.
We're not going to put Third Eye Blind on it, are we?
I think we'll spare you that. So next week on the show, we've got another unbelievable guest, one that I was incredibly excited about, which is Mr. John Ronson, who has joined us from the US of A, which is very exotic and exciting. Mm. And he was very generous with his time. We discussed loads of interesting things like Paul is Dead conspiracy theories and the parallels to that and certain things that are going on in the States. And also one of the all-time great rock and roll anecdotes.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, like, we got pretty tangential, didn't we? Because we kind of talked around about lots of other subjects and obviously talked about Frank Sidebottom and John Ronson's film Frank about that, and talked about outsider art as well.
Yeah,
but it was really interesting. So I hope you'll find it interesting too.
Yeah, there's loads and loads to look forward to in that. So please do subscribe and we'll have another episode for you on Tuesday. As always, please do rate the show. If you give us a 5-star rating, it's incredibly helpful and it helps other people find the podcast. And if you do enjoy it and you want to help us continue to make it, then you can offer us a couple of quid to cover the podcast costs by going to personalbeatles.com/donate. Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.